Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu. Support for the Think podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Most nature photographers will tell you, getting the perfect shot of an elephant or a hummingbird or a leopard seal underwater can involve weeks and months of watching, waiting, and planning before they ever click the shutter. Terry Virts doesn't work that way. In a little over 200 days of travel, he captured more than 300,000 images and shared some of the best with an eager audience on Twitter and Instagram. If you did the math, you realize that is something like 1,500 photos a day. But you see, Virts wanted to make the most of his field location because his subject was the planet Earth and he was shooting from space. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Terry Virts piloted the space shuttle Endeavour and commanded the International Space Station, transitioning between its 42nd and 43rd missions. He may be trained as a pilot and astronaut, but his new book of photography reveals the soul of an artist, and it shares details of very good days and very bad days in orbit around the Earth. The book is a National Geographic publication. It's called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Terry Virts joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City to talk about it. Terry, welcome to Think.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I feel this is the height of irony. I'm a Texan, and I had to travel all the way to New York City to do this interview back in Texas.
Well, next time you'll have to come straight into the studio here in Dallas.
Yeah, let's do that.
So you spent a decade with NASA before you were selected to be the pilot on the Endeavour. What was a regular workday like for you when you were preparing for that mission?
One of my favorite things about being an astronaut is that every day is different. It's not, you know, go in and do the same thing every day. So part of it is training, and I was learning how to fly the space shuttle as a pilot, learning how to do orbital operations like science experiments and maintenance. But you also have to learn medical training. I was a crew medical officer, like the doctor. I was the dentist on my recent space flight. I actually did the first ever tooth filling in space. I had to learn how to be a photographer and how to do radio interviews and how to do spacewalks. And we spent a lot of time flying jets, which is probably the best and most important training. So every day was different.
Somebody has to really trust you to let you do the very first dental filling that you've ever done.
I think it was, it's like if you lose your filling and you need it replaced, you're willing to get that done.
Yeah. So you include really detailed descriptions of what it's like to launch. It's incredibly arduous. Everybody understands that it's dangerous. What I had never heard before is that if somehow you had gone off course at launch when you were scheduled with Endeavour to dock at the ISS, NASA might have chosen to execute what's called a flight termination. What is that?
Yeah, our first trip to the Kennedy Space Center was a brand new astronaut, and we're all eager. We call them ASCANs, which is it really kind of puts you in your place, astronaut candidate. Mm-hmm. And we're getting the tour, and they're showing us the launch center, and here's the engineers. They hit the red button to launch you. And actually not, but there was a big red button there. So I'm always one to ask the question, and I raise my hand, hey, what's the red button for? And the poor Kennedy Space Center worker guy looks at me like the blood just drained from his face. And he was like, honestly, you don't know what that is? And I said, I have no idea. What is that? That's a big red button. And he was like, oh, that's the flight termination system. So if the shuttle launched, we had some manual procedures. We could manually fly it to try and make sure that it headed eastbound into orbit. But if the computers were messed up, the guidance system went wrong, and it started heading westbound towards Disney World, NASA would actually, blow up the rockets before it went into any area that would be dangerous to people on the ground. So thankfully, they never had to use it. I'm sure they never will. But it was a system that was there and we were all like, whoa, we didn't know what we got ourselves into. But that was quite an experience.
So every moment of the day, at least when you're on a shuttle mission, is scheduled far in advance in these 5-minute increments. I wonder about the self-discipline it took not to just sit there with your mouth open, pondering the fact that you're a human being outside the Earth's atmosphere.
Well, the shuttle missions were so busy. We used to say the shuttles were a sprint and a long duration, half-year station mission was more like a marathon. My experience was my long duration mission was more like a sprint that lasted for 6 months or 7 months in my case. I mean, there's just a lot of work to be done. The taxpayers sent a lot of money to send us into space. And, you know, the mission of the station is science. And so they keep us very busy. My shuttle flight was literally down to the minute for 2 weeks. And the day after I landed, I got back to Earth and I slept for 13 and a half hours in a row without budging. And I don't think I had done that since I was probably 6 months old. But I was that's just how tired I had gotten during the 2 weeks.
Were you always behind the lens when you took pictures, or were there ever times when you just set up a camera and let it fire at will?
Well, the individual pictures of places, I was behind the lens, but a lot of the still images I took were time lapses where you set it up and you can't touch it. You can't be behind the lens. You have to get away from it. And then we would put it usually on either 2 or 4 frames a second, depending on if it was day or night, and just let it run for a minute or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, depending on what you were shooting. And then you could take all those still images, so a few hundred still images or maybe 1,000, and then you can take those and turn them into a video. So I have a lot of short video clips of auroras or cities at night or the Earth during the day. And the IMAX movie we filmed, Beautiful Planet, had a lot of those images that were taken in time-lapse from a still camera, and then they got converted into movie format.
Something that's really going to stick with me is the fact that often when you were taking photographs, your orientation was the opposite of what we would think, which is to say the Earth seemed to be above you and all the rest of space, the rest of the universe looked like it was below.
It's really interesting. I actually had the honor of installing the cupola on the final space station assembly flight on my shuttle Endeavour flight. And the cupola is a 7-windowed module. It's the best place in space. It's everybody's favorite place to hang out. And it is on the bottom of the space station. So as the station flies around the Earth, the cupola is down looking at Earth. And so when you're in it, your head is down towards the Earth. And actually, Mike Massimino, a fellow astronaut, he was our Capcom, and he said, "Hey, guys, do you feel like a gopher sticking your head up through the hole? Or do you feel like a bat hanging down looking at the Earth?" And it was interesting because different astronauts had different sensations. For me, it always felt like I was upright and the Earth was just up there above me. But it is a weird perspective change that your brain gets used to.
What does it feel like right after launch as gravity diminishes and you go from the sensation that you have weight to the sensation of weightlessness?
It is an amazing experience. It's something that you just can't get on Earth for more than a few seconds, the sensation of weightlessness. And you're going through this amazing vibration and shaking and noise and roaring and acceleration, and you're getting smashed into your seat. And then the engines shut down, and it is like somebody flips a light switch and turns on the anti-gravity machine. And from my feeling, it felt like the strongest force that had ever hit me had just happened. Like somebody turned on this weightlessness machine, and it just pushes everything. Your body, it pushes fluid up into your face, everything that, or your pencil and your checklist and your socks and your food, and everything just wants to float away from you. And it really takes time. There's a learning curve. The first few days, it's pretty steep, and it really goes on for weeks until you're really good at floating.
So I think most of us have only maybe experienced something remotely like that, maybe in a roller coaster, you know, in that moment when it starts to drop. Is there a euphoria that you experience?
It was sort of like that, yeah. We were flying into sunrise and seeing this amazingly beautiful thing that you've just never seen before, and experiencing weightlessness that you've never felt like that before. It kind of is euphoric. It's like, wow, this is the most amazing thing. And then my entire spaceflight from before the shuttle lifted off until years later at the end of my 200-day mission, every part of my spaceflight was like a juxtaposition of this amazing, sublime experience with get back to work. You got mundane work to do. And it was continuously, hey, you're flying the space shuttle, but oh my God, look out the window. That's unbelievable. But get back to work because we're all launching, you know. And it was this continuous ping pong back and forth.
And of course, you're operating with a brain that evolved only for gravity. From the time that, you know, your distant ancestors were like protozoa, there has been gravity.
We were designed and we work really well in gravity. So humans have force sensors on your feet so you can tell which way is down. If you're sitting in a chair right now, you can feel that down is toward your butt, right? That's where the force is. You can look with your eyes and see where the ceiling is and where the floor is, so you know that. And if you close your eyes, your body also has accelerometers and rate sensors, just like the space shuttle does, just like the F-16 fly-by-wire airplanes do. And they allow you to have balance when you're nighttime. So it's a pretty good, the human body is a pretty well-designed system. And it all, so the only thing that works in space is your visual. When you close your eyes, those rate sensors and accelerometers don't work. They don't feel anything. And that can really trick your brain. And the force sensors, you may like have your feet in a foot loop, or you may be feeling something, but whatever force you're feeling is not necessarily towards the earth. It's not gravity. There's no up or down. So the human neurovestibular system, the balance, is really tricky in space.
How did you get fluent in Russian in preparation to command the ISS?
Fluent in Russian is a strong term.
Competent in Russian.
Very few people are fluent, yeah. But it's funny, you know, the first decade was the hardest. So I love languages. I was a French minor at the Air Force Academy. When I lived in Germany, I just kind of picked it up. It just stuck to my brain. Russian, on the other hand, was more Teflon on my brain. And so it just took a long time. And I learned it while being an astronaut, while having young kids. I was a busy guy. So I didn't have a lot of time to really learn it until I went there and really focused on it for the flight. And it was a super important experience. My time with the Russians, and let's jump into the subject there. But, you know, while I was there, it was Crimea, it was the Ukrainian Civil War, it was sanctions, and here I was flying with Russians. And so that was an important part of having a strong crew and maintaining friendships and relationships, was trying to speak their languages as best, if badly, as I could.
You implicitly trusted your Russian colleagues, and you like them as well.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, you're in space together, and if you screw up, you're going to kill everybody. So you just have to trust each other. There was no politics or, you know, whatever. Culturally, the Russians were great. I found them to be more like Texans than is the best way to describe the Russian culture. It's very practical. It's very no-nonsense, and it was a really great part of the flight.
How did their food rations compare with yours?
That was another highlight of the flight. So there's Russian food. They have a certain food lab, and they launch, you know, bags of Russian food. And we have NASA food, and the Europeans have European food. And the good thing is, if you fly on a mixed crew, you can get a little bit of each in the variety. So they have a lot of just meat and potatoes, and their mashed potatoes were the best. And a lot of fish. NASA food really didn't have fish. It was something that was lacking. And I like fish, so it was great to get like tin cans of, you know, kind of 1940s military style rations, but this really good fish. So you can select like 9 bags of, they call it bonus food, and you can get candy bars or peanuts or whatever. So several of my bonus food bags, I selected Russian food, and the Russians did the same thing. They would pick American food for their bonus containers just to get the diversity.
How different was the experience physically of launching in the Soyuz rocket from launching in the Endeavour?
Yeah, so there's a lot of similarities in that you start off in crew quarters and you take the bus out to the launch pad and you have a little ceremony and you get in your suit. So there's a lot of similarities of the experience, but the actual launch itself is very different. The shuttle is this big, gigantic, 4-million-pound muscle car. My proudest moment of my life as an American was standing there at the launch pad looking up at this beautiful spaceship that we had built. It was really a great experience as an American. The solid rocket boosters put out 10,000 pounds a second each of fuel. It's not really fuel efficient, right? 10,000 pounds of gas is being burned every second
in each Corvette.
One of the two. And those things shake and vibrate and make noise like you cannot imagine. It's a really vibrating, violent launch on the shuttle. The Soyuz, on the other hand, is basically an old Soviet ICBM. It's a nuclear rocket that they put a capsule on top of. And so it's designed to get up and go. You launch in that thing and you are gone in a hurry, and it's very smooth. So a different physical experience.
My guest is astronaut Terry Virts. He piloted the space shuttle Endeavour and commanded the International Space Station. His new book of photography is called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be right back.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is astronaut Terry Virts. He was commander of the International Space Station and piloted the shuttle Endeavour. His new book is called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Terry, we've all seen pictures of the ISS. There are interiors and exteriors. I'll confess, I've had a hard time getting a good sense of how much space you have to move around in any one chamber.
Yeah, it's a big, big thing. If it was brought down to Earth, it wouldn't fit inside a football stadium. It's the solar arrays and the living modules are bigger than that. But as far as the living space that has air and where we go, it's bigger than a 747, so if you can imagine that big airplane with no seats in it. There's lots of volume. The volume is all in modules. So each module is like the size of one of the rooms in your house, and it's connected to another module through a hatch. So you don't get the sense that it's as big as a 747. You just get the sense that you're in a room, but you can kind of float from one module to the next. And it's actually pretty big. It's a very, 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 very cluttered place. There's lots of wires. There's lots of computers. There's just equipment everywhere. But it is pretty good size. And I thought I would, and I never did, get cabin fever. In 200 days, I really felt at home. It wasn't ever a problem.
You write about one of your Russian colleagues getting a treat from home. You floated by and heard what you could have sworn was birds singing.
I know where you're going with this. I did. I was floating through the very middle, what's called Node 1. It was the first American module back in 1998, and I heard birds. And I stopped, and I pushed myself back, and I looked into Node 3, where the exercise machine was, and Misha Kornienko was in there lifting weights. And I said, Misha, what's going on in Russian? And he laughed. And I said, is there a bird in there? And he's like, no. So the Russian psychologist had sent up MP3 sounds from Earth, and they have a lot of great things that they do with spaceflight. They understand things pretty well, and I had not realized that I had been in space for 4 or 5 months, and the station is very nice. It's clean. It's metal and plastic and 72 degrees, and it never rains, and it's not humid, and it's just very nice and sterile. And when I heard the birds, it was such an amazing thing. They also sent us sounds of rain. They sent us sounds from a beach, just waves coming in on a beach. They sent us the sound of a cafe. You could hear glass clanging and people talking. And these sounds were something I had no idea how much I had missed. But everybody loved it. So we took, that weekend, we took all the laptops. And basically, the station probably has 100 laptops. It's what controls the space station. And we put the rain MP3 on all the laptops. So everywhere you went on the space station, you could hear lightning and rain. And by Sunday night, we were ready to open the hatch, and then it all was like, that's enough rain. We're tired of the rain. So we went around and turned the rain off. So it was pretty funny. But it was great. And so I actually, once these files came up from the Russian psychologist, I started going to bed at night by listening to rain. I'd put my little Bose headsets on and plug it into my laptop and just drift off to sleep to the sound of rain. It was pretty cool.
Is it noisy in the shuttle in the same way that it is like on an airplane flight? If we're sitting on a jet, there's kind of a hum at all times?
Yeah, that's probably a really good analogy. I don't know exactly what the decibel level is. And it also depends on the module. There's some modules that are really loud. I mean, like it's hard to talk. And then there's other modules that are really pretty quiet and you don't notice the noise. But there is always noise because there's always fans running. Because the air always has to be manually circulated in order to prevent carbon dioxide from building up. So if you don't have fans or air circulation and you're just sitting there, you'll get a carbon dioxide bubble around your head. And we actually had, we can talk about the ammonia emergency if you want, but we had this big emergency and I ended up having to sleep in the storage module called PMM. And there was no good circulation down there. And like I tried to go to sleep and all of a sudden my head started hurting and my lips were tingling. And that's the symptoms of carbon dioxide. So then I moved my sleeping bag to a different spot to try and get some airflow. And then all of a sudden I started getting the CO2 symptoms. So trying to sleep in a module without good ventilation really made me feel like, you know, I could tell, yep, they were right. If there's no circulation, you get the CO2 bubble. And I got to experience that.
So let's talk about this ammonia emergency. Over and over, these like klaxons started going off. You were hearing that there was an ammonia leak, which is something that is, I mean, you were told by the time you can smell ammonia with your human nose, it's too late.
That's right. And then, of course, in Houston, with all the plants there, you know, a lot of folks know ammonia is a dangerous chemical.
Yeah.
And it's what we use as a coolant. So your car has a radiator fluid. Well, the American segment of the station uses ammonia, which is great for taking heat out of the equipment and putting it out into space. It's a great radiator fluid. It's just deadly. This is the only problem. So there, you know, there we were mining. All my best flying stories start with, there I was minding my own business. And we were sitting there. It was the middle of the day, just doing some work. And the alarm goes off. And it's a no-doubter. It's like the Star Trek emergency alarm. There's no doubt that there's an emergency going on. And Samantha, Christopher Eddie, and I popped our heads out and we looked. And on the panel, there's a air leak, there's a fire, and there's an ATM for not Texas A&M, but atmosphere. And what it means is toxic atmosphere. And I saw that ATM. And in the history, 15-year history of the station, there's been a bunch of false fire alarms. They happen pretty often. Smoke detectors just make a mistake. There's been a few false leaks. But there's never been an ammonia alarm. That's the worst one. And when I saw ATM, my brain went, atmosphere, is the atmosphere leaking? And Samantha was like, no, that's an ammonia leak. And I said, God, you're right. And so we put on our oxygen masks, float down to the Russian segment real fast, shut the hatch. You're supposed to take all your clothes off, because if there's ammonia in your clothes, that would be deadly. And then but we didn't, because we were like, nah, there's probably not ammonia. And then we went through the next hatch, shut that. And then we spent quite a bit of time with these special sampling kits, just like they use in the chemical plants, to make sure there was no ammonia. Houston called us up probably 30 minutes later or so and said, just kidding, that was a false alarm. So we were like, oh, all right. That killed the day's schedule. We started to clean up. We go back to the American segment. We're putting everything away. And maybe 20 or 30 minutes later, our Capcom, a guy named Vegas Kelly, Jim Kelly, calls us up in a really stern, listen to me now voice. This is an actual emergency. Execute your ammonia emergency procedures. This is an actual emergency. So hearing this stern voice, we thought, all right, this is no kidding, the real thing. Went through the same thing again, put oxygen masks on, float down the Russian segment, close the hatch. And this time, we went through the whole thing. The Russian air is clean. We took our masks off. And then we kind of stared at each other and we were like, the station's going to die. I mean, what we had assumed had happened was there was some small leak and the computer triggered the alarm. And then Houston said, no, it's probably not real. And after some time, and I knew Mission Control was completely studying and analyzing what was happening, we had assumed that they had said, you know what, this really is a real ammonia leak. It's small, but we'll have to get them to do it. And if there's an ammonia leak, the station would eventually overpressurize and pop, or they would actually have to vent the ammonia out into space, in which case there would be no cooling fluid for the station. Hmm. And in any case, once there's ammonia in there, you can't clean it out in space. You could depressurize it, which would kill the equipment in the station because it's not designed to operate a vacuum. And then even if you had enough air to repressurize it, which we don't, that ammonia would still be stuck to the wall. So we literally went through all these scenarios in our head and spent the afternoon, us and the Russians and everybody, going, the station's going to be done. In a few weeks, we'll come back to Earth and we're the last people that will ever be up here. While we were up there, in the midst of all these things happening with the Russians, with sanctions and Crimea, Dmitry Rogozin, who's the deputy prime minister, actually called us. He was the guy that actually, he walked me out to my Soyuz for launch. And he called us up and said, hey, American colleagues, you can stay as long as you want. We're going to work together. And it was a great moment of, look, all this bad political thing stuff is happening on the planet, but here we are in space working together. And it was probably one of the highlights of my mission, just to show the international cooperation that was happening. So we spent the whole day, and finally by the evening, and what I didn't know is that Houston was really close to venting that ammonia line, which would have had really bad consequences for the station if they had done it. So we waited there for hours, and they called us up and said, just kidding, it was a false alarm. So go back into the American segment, but just in case, keep your masks on and do some sampling. So I went back in there with my crewmate, and we sampled. But it was like an alien movie. It was like going into this deserted spaceship that had been abandoned, and it was really eerie, and it was really, you know, things were still floating around as we had left them. That was definitely a surreal experience to float into an abandoned spaceship and be the first people with masks on and sampling. And it, so that was a story that probably not many people have heard, but it's one of the chapters in the book.
All right. So I want to talk about spacewalks. I know that you train for years to do this sort of thing. You practice. I know that you were chosen for the space program because you're a special kind of person who is really calm. But I have to ask you, that first moment that your fragile human body exits a spacecraft and you're just floating in space, like, what happens to your breathing and your heart rate? Is there that feeling of like standing on top of a very high height and looking down?
So that's actually something, it's an unknown. And some astronauts really have a sense of vertigo because you go outside and you're in space and the Earth is, like, when you look at it, you feel like you can fall down there. And some guys have really had that sensation. So what I did to kind of just hammer home in my brain, I went outside, I put my waist tethered, this little bungee cord, I attached it to the handrail, and then I let go. Outside in space for 5 seconds, I put the tether down and I let go. And I just sat there, I kind of looked around. All right, I'm not going to fall, I'm good to go. I picked up the waist tether and I went on about my business. So it was something that I just wanted to, you know, prove to myself. It's kind of like stand on the ledge of the building. All right, I'm okay. I'm not going to fall over. I kind of had to get through that. And then from then on, it was business. You're on the clock. You know, you got to get moving because spacewalks are very, very busy time.
But in those 5 seconds, did you have that kind of loose muscle feeling where you can't even make a fist?
I didn't. It was more I just wanted to prove to myself and make sure I didn't have. I have a funny story. I don't know how long till the next break, but when you go out, you check your buddy over. I'm tethered, you're tethered, your equipment's good, I'm good. All right, let's go. And then you go to your work sites and start working. And normally in the pool, I would reach out in Houston where we practice about 5 feet over to the next module, grab onto that, and then go, and it's a shortcut. Otherwise, you have to take about 2 or 3 minutes and go over 20 feet of the station and take the long way around. So I check my buddy over, he checks me over, all right, we're ready to go. And I started to reach out across that module, and I stopped, brought my hand back, and I'm like, I'm going to take the long way. And I just stayed on structure and took the long way around. Well, not that I was afraid, but it was more like, all right, this is the big leagues right here. I'm not in the minor leagues anymore, and I'm just going to make sure everything goes smoothly. So that was my first few minutes outside.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astronaut Terry Virts. We're talking about his new book, View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. We'll go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Harold is calling from McKinney. Hi, Harold.
Hello. As a backyard astronomer, I wonder what the stars look like from space, and do you recognize the constellations like we recognize when we're looking up, and what do meteors look like?
So those are great questions here. I have to say the audio that we got made it sound like Stephen Hawking. The voice is modulated. It sounds like Stephen Hawking just called in with a question. I'm the same as you. I'm a backyard astronomer. I had a little 6-inch reflector when I was a kid. And so I know like the basic constellations. I'm definitely not an expert. And I'll tell you, while I was in space, I literally could not recognize a constellation the entire time, except for maybe Orion once. There are so many stars. And you're upside down, so like the head is towards the Earth, and you don't know if you're in the northern hemisphere or southern hemisphere. You're flying so fast. We had an app. We have an iPad with like a star chart app, but it was useless because it's based on a fixed latitude, and what you're seeing is not based on that latitude. So constellations were just not visible to me. The planets were, and I actually could see Mercury, which was really cool because, you know, many people have probably never seen Mercury or even noticed that they were looking at it. And in space, I saw it fairly often. Meteors, on the other hand, I hardly ever saw, but the times that I saw them, it's looking down towards Earth. Because, you know, away from Earth, there's no air, so you're not going to see that, or the meteorite flash. So when you see those, you're looking down.
You experienced a strange phenomenon that's been called cosmic ray visual phenomenon. What is that exactly?
So I'd read about this from Apollo astronauts, and they actually, the first guys didn't want to say anything because they were afraid that the NASA flight docs would say that they were crazy. But what this happened, it was my fifth night on my first space flight. It was flight night five. I was going to bed on the shuttle. I closed my eyes, and I saw this giant white flash. And I immediately opened my eyes, and I said, that's it. So there are these particles, galactic cosmic radiation, they call it. They're heavy molecules and atoms that are flying really, really fast, and they go right through the station. And if they hit your optic nerve, they give you this white flash. And every astronaut experiences them different. Some rarely see them. Some see them often. And for me, every time I saw it, it was a different pattern, but it's some kind of like just white flash with different shapes. It was weird to see something flash without any sound. Every time on Earth you see something flash, there's usually a sound. And my first reaction was cool. And then until I realized what was happening, and you know, if that radiation's going through your optic nerve, there's probably 1,000 other ones going through all the other tissue in your body. So it's an interesting thing. Patients that have brain cancer and get proton therapy through their brain often will see the same thing with a massive dose of radiation. But radiation is a funny thing. There's quantity and there's quality. And the types of radiation we get in space just doesn't exist on Earth because the Earth's atmosphere blocks it. And so that was quite a phenomenon.
Do you worry about that for the long term of your health?
I think it's the biggest issue that we face. So the space station has shown, I was there for 200 days. I came back and had lost 0% of my bone density. I did 20 pull-ups the week I got back. You know, I was physically in good shape. But the radiation is an unknown, and I've had some, some skin issues, and it's something that, and we haven't really studied that. There was the year in space study where they looked pre and post, but they're not looking at DNA pre and post for astronauts. And it's something that I think we need to start focusing on a little bit more.
Astronaut Terry Virts is my guest. He piloted the Space Shuttle Endeavour and commanded the International Space Station. His new book is called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with astronaut Terry Virts, who commanded the International Space Station and piloted the Space Shuttle Endeavour. His new book of photography is called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Join us at 800-933-5372. Terry, what is it like to see an aurora from orbit?
Auroras are amazing. I had never really seen them from Earth, so my first real experience with auroras was from space. And for me, looking, especially the Northern Lights, was always like this familiar ghost. The ghost is back, seeing it tonight. And you can actually see it move and dance in real time. Our eyes are made to see mostly black and white at night and mostly color during the day. But you can still perceive the green and the red. The cameras that we have now, a few years ago, the cameras couldn't pick them up. But now the chips are sensitive enough that they really show this bright green aurora, and your eyes actually do see that color, just not quite so bright. But what surprised me most is that you can see this thing moving in real time.
You also got a really clear picture of the geographic distribution of wealth on the planet.
That surprised me. My first flight, I was flying around the world, and I noticed during the daytime, you just really don't notice humans. If you were looking at London or New York or Dallas, you can look down and you'll see some gray concrete. But unless you're looking for it, if you were an alien just passing by, you may not notice unless you were looking. But at nighttime, it's a different story. There's the city lights really show up. You can see some city lights are white. Some are this yellowish, orangish color. Sometimes there's red, like oil well flares are red. But it hit me after five or six nights of watching this that what I was seeing was not population, but rather wealth. And so America is full of lights, right? Lots and lots of people in America, lots and lots of lights. Western Europe, full of people, a couple hundred million people, lots of lights. And that's a good thing because, you know, the people, the quality of life is there. But in Africa, for example, the Nile is really noticeable at night. There's lots of lights around the Nile and Cairo and Alexandria. You can tell that people flock to the water. And then in southern Africa, there's Johannesburg, and there's a lot of city lights. It looks like a European city in Johannesburg. And in between those two places, there are literally almost no lights. I mean, there's a few dots here and there, and there's almost no lights. And there's a billion people between those two places. And it just struck me that, wow, that's, you know, you can really see the human condition there. And the most striking way to see the human condition from space is to see the Korean Peninsula, where, you know, Seoul, South Korea is this bright, shining city. It's on the Mount Rushmore of bright cities at night. And the whole South Korean country is full of lights. And obviously, you know, the economy is booming there. And in China, there's just city after city of a million people or more, lots of lights on. And in between China and North Korea, there is this gigantic black hole. It looks like at first, when I first saw it, I thought, wow, that's this ocean. But I flew F-16s or I don't remember a sea. And I was like, wait a minute, that's North Korea. There's a little white dot where Pyongyang is. So same number of people in the north, same number of people in the south. And, you know, one people are living in the light and one people are living in the dark. So you could see humanity on Earth in a different light at nighttime from space.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Alfonso is calling us from Houston. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi, I had a question. Living here in Houston, I've gotten to ask this question of another astronaut. What did you feel was more terrifying, takeoff or reentry, and why?
It's funny. Well, I never, the only time I felt terrified was when I had to cut my crewmate's hair, Samantha, because I did not want to mess that up, my Italian crewmate. But the thing I say is that getting into space is really hard. I mean, it's hard to go from 0 to 17,000 miles an hour. But getting back from space is harder, and that really struck home when I came back in the shuttle and saw the fireball and the explosions outside of the window and this plasma. A lot more countries have put things into orbit than have brought them back from orbit. And the same can be said of companies also. So getting back from orbit is just something, it's the same amount of energy at 17,500 miles an hour worth of energy that you got to take out of the vehicle. And it's a hard thing to do, and you want to land in the right spot slowly. And so I actually, after flying in space, I had more, look, the launch is spectacular. But the pilot in me kind of has more respect for the landing phase than the launch.
When you landed after being on the ISS, you're just out in this field somewhere. Can you explain about the place where the craft touched down or floated down? Ultimately?
So on the space shuttle, we landed in Florida. We had a nice runway, and Sambo, our commander, did a great landing. The Russian Soyuz lands in Kazakhstan. And if you look on the map, Google nowhere, and then look right in the middle of that is the landing site. Yeah. So it's a gigantic flat field, which is an amazing, you know, thing to have in your territory. It's a great place to land space capsules. And they knew where we were coming. They were tracking us. And literally, we were under parachute. The Russian helicopters were already calling us on the radio. And as soon as we landed, within minutes, they were right there on us. So it wasn't like we were lost in the middle of Kazakhstan. But it really is. It's the tundra. It's hundreds of miles of nothing. And that's where we landed.
You grew while you were in space.
I did. I was finally 6 feet tall. It was great. And I lost a lot of weight. But like most weight loss programs, you gain it all back when you come back. But yeah, I got over 6 feet tall. But the doctor said within a few hours after landing, I was back to 5'10". But the growing part and shrinking part gives a lot of guys back pain. It's not permanent, but just, you know, for a few days your back hurts as you're stretching out. And I actually craved, they have this little like camping chair. It's just a little Velcro kind of thing that you can sit in it, and it makes it feel like you're sitting down. And my first few weeks in space, I would just when I went into my crew quarters to type email or something, I would put myself in this chair, and it just felt really good to feel like I was sitting down.
So you're a guy with a family. I wonder, like, are you emailing your kids about homework? How much contact were you able to have back and forth?
That was actually a super important part of the mission. NASA provides us with some good contact anyway with home. There's a phone. When you have the right line of sight with the right satellite, you can make a phone call. It's actually the world's best phone because you can call anywhere on Earth for free and nobody can call you. So it's a perfect phone, and except for it just randomly cuts off occasionally, which is a good way to get off the phone if you're ready to be done talking. And we could do email. And they would give us a Skype kind of video conference every weekend. So, but it's hard, you know, it's hard on your families. There's a lot of aspects of spaceflight that are very difficult. And they're sitting there, you know, hoping that you're okay. And we had this ammonia emergency, another, had an issue during a spacewalk one time. And it's tough. It's a lot harder on the families, and there's not necessarily the benefits. They definitely get the short end of the straw sometimes from NASA.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Jeff in Plano. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Terry. I can't wait to get the book and see the pictures, so I'm not certain what they all look like. But I'm also wondering if you had time, and it sounds like you did answering one of the earlier questions, to look around, not just down, at other spacecraft. I mean, you're up there with other satellites. Did you ever take the time to look for some, or were you checking schedules to see when some would come near you to see them?
Yeah, that's a great question. The book has still images, and so it's hard to see, but I did a lot of time-lapse photography, and I posted some on Twitter and Instagram, and when I give my talks, I show these time-lapse views, and I would make a time-lapse at night, and I'd go back and watch it and kind of preview it, and while you're watching these star, like the galaxy go by or going around in orbit, you'll see these satellites fly by, and I can remember many times going, "Oh wow, oh wow. Oh, man, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's all these satellites flying around that you don't normally necessarily see with your own eyes. But as I filmed them and I went back and watched it, you can see, you know, there's a lot of things flying around. Now, thankfully, most of it's not at our orbit. I did have to maneuver the station. China, about a decade ago, blew up a satellite with a anti-satellite military weapon. And they did it at the same orbital altitude as the station. So every few months, we have to maneuver the station to avoid the debris that they caused. And even though it's been a decade, that debris is still there. So I actually had to maneuver while I was there for some orbital debris. But it was something that I was definitely aware of. But, you know, mostly I saw it in video, not with my own eyes.
How small could an object be and cause real problems?
So when I went out on the spacewalk, you could see all over the station. I mean, not like every inch, but I saw quite a few little small dents in the handrails or in equipment. Where maybe a flake of paint from a rocket booster was floating around and it hit the station going a few kilometers a second, or some small piece of dust, or who knows, you know, something would hit it. So you could see little divots all over the outside of the station. In fact, one of our tasks on a spacewalk was to go put a clamp and cover up this big divot that had sharp edges on it. And we don't want sharp edges because that might cut your spacesuit and make a leak. So it's something that we're definitely aware of. The Air Force tracks probably 60,000 or so pieces of debris in orbit. So those things we don't worry about because we can maneuver to avoid them. The really small things we don't worry about because they don't cause that much damage. It's the really big things we don't worry about because we can see. It's kind of the middle-sized things that we're not tracking that's the concern. And thankfully, so far, that hasn't been a problem. And, you know, we've had very safe operations from that.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is astronaut Terry Virts. We're talking about his new book, View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Let's go next on the phone to Eric in Austin. Hi, Eric.
Hey, guys. So, Terry, I was the photographer on an expedition down the Rio Grande River in 2014 and came across a group of astronaut candidates who were going through geology training with geologist Paul Bauer. I was wondering if you went through that training yourself, and how does that training translate when you're in space and you're looking down at Earth?
I did. I got to go through with a gentleman named Bill Mulberger, who's the legend in that community. he trained all the Apollo astronauts, and he trained even me in the 2000s. And so he passed away a few years ago, but he used to complain about the vegetables. He just wanted to see the rocks. He didn't want plants or anything like that out there. And I learned about how to use a gravimeter to find fault lines and all of this really specific geologist stuff, and I loved it. I did mine in New Mexico, and it was a big part. I used to fly with a classmate of mine, Drew Feustel. He's a geologist, fellow astronaut. He's getting ready to launch. And we would go flying in our T-38, and he'd point out, you know, all these geology terms. And I'm like, dude, I'm just a pilot. But it was cool to learn about it. And then when I got in space, you could see, you know, fault lines. Kamchatka was amazing with all the volcanoes there. The Grand Canyon, obviously, from space doesn't look so big. It was kind of small from space, but it was neat to see it. And it was a big part of being able to observe the surface of the Earth through the lens of the geology training that I'd had.
Do you feel like your time in space changed you as a person?
You know, I think my basic belief system and stuff is the same. I hope I have a better perspective of more big picture. When I do speaking, I talk about that, the perspective of, you know, things are probably not as bad as they seem. That, you know, there's been this beautiful sunset. There's been a billion. There's going to be a billion more. And you know, to try and put things in perspective. Hopefully I'm a little bit less of a black and white or edgy person and a little bit more mellow or laid back. But my basic, you know, beliefs were the same. I mainly feel lucky to have gotten this glimpse of creation. It's like I got to see things that at times felt like humans weren't meant to see. And hopefully through the book, you know, it's a photography book, but it's also stories from space and the feeling and the experience of spaceflight. View from Above is not a reference book of geography, and it's also not a memoir of, you know, this is how I became an astronaut. It's the feelings and experience of space, and hopefully people will get that.
Tell us about the very last photograph that you took from space.
So it was day 199 and a half, and we were just about to come back to Earth, and I'd taken all these pictures, and I was like, I want to take one more good one. So I went down to the cupola. I took off. They have this thing called a scratch pane, and I took it off. It's a piece of plastic that's supposed to protect the glass, but it really destroys pictures if the sun is shining through because it smudges. And I set up the camera on F-22 to get the sunburst view, and I put a wide-angle lens on there, and I wanted to get a really beautiful sunset. So I took it, and I looked at the back preview screen on the camera, and I said, that's the best picture I'm ever going to take, and I'm done. And so I took the card out of the camera, put it in the laptop to downlink it, and I went down to the Russian segment and put on my Sokol suit and came back to Earth. And that was the end of my photography experience in space.
Terry,
it's actually at the back of the book.
Terry Virts piloted the Space Shuttle Endeavour and commanded the International Space Station, transitioning between its 42nd and 43rd missions. He's an avid photographer who captured more than 300,000 images during his time in space. The new book is called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Terry, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
It's been wonderful. Glad to be back in Texas virtually.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. The Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can find the podcast anywhere. You can find the podcast plus information about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.